I want to be the CEO of a business that gauges my soul and my mind. And so every morning when I woke up, I would read that statement and I would think about when I made decisions, like, how does this influence my ultimate vision?
Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jory Calkins, the founder and CEO of Enduring Companies and the host of Built to Outlast, a podcast and community for business builders by business builders. We explore the journeys and companies of business builders in America with a focus on traditional small to mid-sized business niches and the strategies which enable them to endure and flourish. If you are building a business now or aspire to build one in the future, this is for you. To join the Built to Outlast community and access episodes, show notes, and other community resources to support your journey, please visit builttooutlast.com. If you have or know a business that may be sold and care who the buyer is, or if you want to buy or build a business and care who you do it with, please visit enduring.co to learn more about us, our long-term approach, and our holding company. Welcome, everyone, for our show today. We're speaking with Brandon Coleman, who is a friend and the CEO of Cotton Patch Cafe, which is a Texas-based American restaurant chain. Welcome to the show, Brandon.
Thank you so much, Jory. Glad to be here.
Before we get started, and we've known each other for a little bit, but I'd love to hear your background, wherever you're comfortable starting, whether it's day one or week one or month one or year five. Tell us about yourself and where you're from.
Well, thanks, first of all, for having me. I'm really excited to be here and to have this conversation. Talking about my background, I'll start growing up in Houston, Texas. My father ran an advertising agency, which he started from nothing and grew to a considerable size. And he was the quintessential ad guy and created this incredible ad agency base, created some really interesting perspectives on branding in the very early days of some of the brand strategy that's going on now. And I grew up really on the floor of his agency a lot of times. He would allow me into creative sessions, much to the chagrin of the creatives. Because nothing is more creative than a young kid who thinks anything is possible. So it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to work with the ideas of clients, to hear how things were being shared, being discussed, and being created. And on the other side, I had my mom. So my parents are divorced since I was about 3 years old. So my dad on one side, I'd spend 1 week with him and get to see the ad agency world. And on the other week, one of the things that my mom brought me into was restaurants. And so she was running a Rio Ranch at the time, which was a restaurant in Houston. And I just learned a tremendous amount about restaurants. Got to hang out with the servers and thought the bartender was the coolest guy in the world. And the host was, you know, I had a crush on the host, even though I was, you know, probably in sixth grade and she was probably in her 20s. You know, it was fun. Like it was, I got to see these two different worlds and I had no idea they would come back together in the end, which is really an interesting series of events. So kind of fast forward and grew up in Houston, went to college at Texas A&M, had a great time there. It's a great school, good business background, graduated with a degree in marketing, business marketing. And from there, I knew I wanted to see a broader perspective, wanted to experience more of the world. And so I went to New York City and worked, I call it worked on Madison Avenue, but it was actually 42nd and Lex.
Before we get there, because I'm super excited to get there, can you share a little bit more about those formative experiences and any specific memories you have of being at the ad agency with your dad and or the restaurants with your mom? Or are there a few, like if you had to rattle off, you know, one or two specific memories from each that you feel like were kind of like formative for you, either with respect to business or just, you know, formative in other ways, what would those memories be?
Man, there's a lot on both sides. I would say from my dad's side with the ad agency, there was a lot of, he gave me a lot of ability to participate in conversations that I should not have been in, right? Like, and I think this idea that, you know, like speak up, be heard, say what you're thinking, your opinion is valuable. Like this whole idea of being able to participate in a lot of these discussions where a kid probably shouldn't have been present in the business meeting, right? That was really awesome. Like it was confidence building, and it just had a big impact on me. And it was cool to see what my dad was doing. I think on the other side, like I really liked the creative aspect of it. And when I first started hanging out at the ad agency, they had they had they were still doing light boards, like they were cutting pictures and drawing things with markers. Okay. And then going to animation and going to like create the ads that way. And then I got to see computers come into the advertising world and like when they first started using them both for business and then also for creative design and stuff like that. And that was really transformative as well. Like just being able to see how technology was changing the way they were doing business at an age where, you know, I wasn't even in high school yet, right? I was probably elementary or middle school. And I remember all of those aspects. I think more than anything from the advertising side was just a sense of confidence and speaking up and saying what you're thinking and just putting your ideas out there and not being afraid to get them shot down. I remember one specific one we were ideating around for a client of my father's, Sawgrass Steakhouse. And we were trying to leverage this big cattle ride that they do, a kind of cattle drive that they do in to set up the rodeo for Houston, Texas, which the rodeo is huge in Houston. And we wanted to do something promotional that got attention. And so, you know, I was throwing ideas from every which direction. I think we actually used a couple, which was
nice,
which was like, again, really empowering. Your ideas matter, so speak up. So I'd say that's the kind of the, if I had to distill it down, you know, it gave me a lot of confidence in that sense. And on my mom's side, you know, I have memories from that. I mean, but some of them probably aren't that accretive to my business sense, but more just comfort in the restaurant industry. When I talk about experiences that were formative, but not necessarily accretive, would be like, you know, I was running around in the back of the house of a restaurant, which is probably not the safest place for a kid. But like I climbed up the roof access one time and was like running around on the roof of Rio Ranch, which is actually attached to a hotel. So like they called the police because they could see a kid on the roof of their restaurant. And I got in so much trouble for that. So that was not the best moment. But I think most of the time it was getting to spend time with like the servers and the back of the house team members. And I would say what it taught me and seeing my mom's interaction with them, what it taught me was putting people first. And so from my dad's side, I got this real speak up, your ideas matter, you know, push, be aggressive, like drive the business. And on the other side, I got this piece that, you know, about people and about lifting people up. And that was something, you know, my mom would do an amazing job of, was just building others up and really kind of putting them up on a platform and making them feel important in their role in running the restaurant. And I think that those are both very true of my kind of leadership today. And I think that people first mentality really came from my mom, and a lot of the business sense really came from my dad. And so it was, they both were formative, regardless of whether or not the police were called. But it was, they both have great experiences. So
you got to push the boundaries sometimes, you know, to know where they are.
Yeah.
That's awesome. It's very cool. That makes me even more excited to talk about kind of later career stuff, because you definitely have both those things are baked into you and what you're doing. So I'm really excited to get there and reference back to some of this experience. So when you're middle school, high school, did you work in restaurants at all? It sounded like you were working at the agency a little bit, or at least participating. Were you working at the restaurant with your mom or other restaurants? Or, you know, did you have any experiences like that in middle school or high school?
Well, I helped out at my mom's restaurant a lot. She didn't own the restaurant, but she was running the restaurant, right? So I helped out a lot there. And then I worked the snack bar at the local pool, because that was the cool job to have. But as far as being a full-time server or back of house team member, I did not. And so that was really interesting, because actually, we'll get to this, but when I come back into restaurants, that was the first question, is like, well, you haven't come up through the restaurant, so you probably don't understand them. And that was a big hurdle for me early on to overcome.
That's fascinating, because you literally grew up in restaurants.
Yeah, it is, because I had a ton of like, immersive experience in restaurants, but not the act, just because I hadn't worked each individual position. And there's a lot to that, right? There's stuff that you learn by working those positions. I'm not minimizing that in any way, but I think I knew more about the high, like the overview of restaurants, than I think maybe somebody who had just worked in a front of house position or just worked in a back of house position. But at the same time, you know, I struggled to communicate that, because they were like, well, what restaurants did you work in, right? It was a badge of honor that you tried to, that people would ask for or want to see. So no, I worked in the snack bar at the local pool, and then I spent a lot of time in the restaurants, you know, hanging out with the servers. I was like a tip multiplier. A lot of times the servers would take me to the tables and be like, this is Brandon. You know, it was kind of slow, and people would write big tips because they thought for some reason I was getting a cut of those, you know. So the servers love to do that.
So you didn't get a cut?
No cuts.
Oh, man. Early lessons yes. in value creation.
Yes.
Well, you did the snack bar, which is kind of like the bartender of the pool. So you got like the cool role.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, you got bomb pops and fruit by the foot.
Okay, so you're in middle school and high school, and then you're off to college. Were you kind of during that period, what were you thinking about in terms of, or for me, the answer was probably not at all, but what were you thinking about in terms of career? Did you know, okay, I want to put these two things together and that's exactly what I'm going to go do? Or was it more of a, you know, an exploratory path in terms of what you were focused on in high school and then college?
I didn't want to do either of those things. I want to be in finance. When I was in high school, there was a gentleman on my street who ran Smith Barney Houston. And so I got an internship there in high school, which was, I learned a lot. It was not the financial career path that I was thinking that I wanted. I was thinking more kind of investment banking, even though I didn't even know what that meant at the time, but more just kind of deal structure finance for bigger businesses. And I didn't really have an idea of what that even meant, right? Like I was just kind of, that's what I want. And so Smith Barney is like, oh, okay, yeah, that's a big name. Let's do that. And the guy who got me the internship was amazing. He's very generous, great guy. Then fast forward to the internship, he put me with one of his advisors, right? Like who's an advisor for people's retirement accounts and whatnot. And the first half of the internship, well, actually, I'd say the first 90% of the internship was working for him. And what he did was he printed out a list of names. And I have no idea where he got them. Gosh, this was the 90s, right? So like he printed out this list of names and dropped it on my desk. And he said, call all these people and invite them to my retirement investment seminar. So literally as a high school kid, I'm sitting there and I'm just cold calling. I'm like, hi, Mrs. Smith. have you considered what you're going to do about your retirement? And man, that was a lesson. I got a lot out of that. And I didn't learn anything about finance, but I learned a lot about selling and like cold calling. And I just took a beating every day because, you know, people were, how the hell did you get this number? And why are you calling me at home on a, you know, during the week? And why are you calling me at my office? You're bothering me. Don't ever call here again. And like, I remember one person was just grilling me so bad that I just came clean. I was like, look, I'm a high school student and I'm on an internship and I'm just trying to help out. Please stop yelling at me.
Wow.
But I spent all summer doing that.
Right into the fire.
Right into the fire.
That's awesome. I mean, what great experience. And also, by the way, that's basically the same thing you were doing for tips at tables.
Yeah. They were much nicer. When you can see somebody face to face, that's another thing I learned. If you have to have a tough conversation, have it face to face. People are much nicer than they are when they're behind a phone or a keyboard, right? So that was quite a learning. But you know, towards the end of that internship, the last 10 to 15%, I got to sit with the traders and learn about, you know, kind of how they were looking at commodities and different things. And that one got my interest back going into finance. And so it wasn't until I took my first finance course in college that I realized that was not where I was going to go. So
I'd love to pick up there in a sec, but I had a very similar experience where for whatever reason, and maybe it's like, this was the thing to do at the time, but I was like, I want to work in finance. I want to work at a bank. And so but I didn't know what the heck that meant. And so I literally walked around our town and I was like, oh, there's a bank. And I walked into like the local retail branch of the bank and said, can I work here? And they were like, sure, you can like be a, you can hand out candy or something when people come in to like withdraw cash. But clearly I was misunderstanding, you know, what that was all about. But
isn't that interesting though? Like why would kids gravitate towards something like that? I'm really interested in that because I don't really know why I was gravitating that way. And I'm curious if you do, because I don't know, is it because, you know, we're taught that like, oh, you got to earn money, so we want to work with money? Or because there's nothing intrinsically like attractive. We didn't even know what it meant. Like, it wasn't like, oh, I want to be a fireman. I go put out fires, right? It's like, we want to work in banks, but we don't actually really know what that means. I'm curious if you knew where yours was coming from, because I have no idea where mine was.
I don't know. I think it's a great question. I haven't fully thought about it. So this is kind of a half-baked thought, but I think it might have been, that's what like people were talking about. Like, that's what I heard grownups talking about. And that was what I saw a lot of people interested in, and what, you know, you're supposed to go make money, and people are talking about banks and bankers. And so I was like, oh, those two must be connected. Why don't I go do that? But clearly, to your point, I had no idea what that was or what that meant. So I didn't mean to make it derail and make it about me. I was just, I thought that was fascinating that we had like a very similar experience in totally different parts of the country at a similar time.
Yeah, that is really interesting.
It must have been something in like the ethos at that time, or, you know, what was popular at that time.
Yeah.
So you're taking your first finance class, and then what about it? How did you realize that, okay, this might be for me? And then what was the next step after that?
So there's certain classes at A&M. Now I know this, but there's certain classes at A&M that are, you know, under the radar called weed out classes. And I think finance was one of those that, you know, we had, I don't know, 300 some odd kids in that classroom or something. I don't know. It was something crazy. It was a gigantic, it was an auditorium. And the teacher, like, class starts at 9 a.m. The second it struck 9 a.m., she would just start talking and writing on a transparency and just talk and write and talk and write. And it was formula. And it was just information like fire hydrant. There was no interest built into it. He didn't show interest. There was nothing curious about it. And what's sad about that is now in my role as a CEO, like, finance is where I consistently drift into metrics, the numbers, performance, and how do we create value? And I think really focusing on the P&L, but there's so much to get into and so many interesting things in there. This was just general finance and time value money equations and, you know, like all sorts of return equations, which now I love, but there was no love given. So there was no love found, right? So she just wrote and she just read. And the whole thing was, you just have to memorize the test and then you answer the test and then you get through it. And that's not the way I work, right? Like, and so I think some kids just excel at that. I could not, right? Like, I retook the course multiple times. So like, they have this thing at A&M where you can drop it before you get your grade for the final year. I did that twice for the same class. And I was a smart kid. Like, I didn't have any interest in it because there was no interest created, no interest found. So.
Well, and you also grew up in like a fully immersive experience. I mean, you were like in the weeds, in the action. You know, someone just lobbing equations at you is probably not going to resonate, especially with almost everyone, but especially for someone who was, you know, had the experiences as a younger kid that you had.
That's an interesting perspective. I never thought about it that way, but you're right. I was very hands-on. Like, I was very much involved in the data. So like, if this would have been a smaller class and they'd been like, hey, let's do something fun. Let's show you how this works, right? Like, let's create interest around time, value, money. Let's create interest on, you know, cash on cash returns. Like, let's create like a real world scenario instead of just the bunch of equations. Then I might be in investment banking today. So, again, our paths are complicated and I am very happy with where I am today. So,
yeah, if only she had taught about like tips and unit economics and cold calling funnels, who knows? Could be a different,
world. If she would have got me the adjusted EBITDA, I'd have been right there. I was like, wait, so you can put really a lot of things into adjusted EBITDA.
Wait, so it's basically a made-up number?
and businesses sell based off of this, right? Okay, cool. I'm excited.
I can do that. You could use your creative background. You know, all sorts of creativity can go into that.
That's right. Awesome. Creative thinking.
All right, so you're in this, you know, freshman class that is, you know, for a number of reasons not resonating with you, and it sounds like many others. What did you turn to? Did you then immediately know, okay, if not this, then that? Or, you know, what was the next couple months or year or two like in terms of you exploring, you know, what do I want to go do?
I didn't do much exploration. I kind of just jumped straight into marketing because the same point of what we were just talking about on creating an immersive experience. This teacher really created an immersive experience around marketing, around taking a business through different cycles and what that meant and showing examples and case studies. And it just instantly became more intriguing to me. Heart surgeons earn a lot of money because they do something very difficult, but it's almost simplistic, right? Because the heart is a known quantity. There's different valves that do different things, but everything, like, they know about heart surgery, right? It's a high stakes surgery, and it's very, I don't want to call it simplistic, but it's there's not a lot of gray area, right?
It's like a defined problem.
Psychology, on the other hand, right, it's a defined problem, right? There's inputs, there's outputs. We kind of know everything. The psychology is very complex, right? Because we don't know everything about kind of how the brain's working and thoughts. And so I would say, like, to me, that was why marketing was more attractive, right? There's art and science still in it today. And we lean a lot more science, a lot of the KPIs and metrics that we have. But the art side is what is interesting. You can run the exact same, like, very targeted, very intelligent campaign targeting the right audience. And if you change the color of the creative, you get a different output. But if you change the message, you get an exponentially better output, right? And so what is that right message? And so it's not just about putting something in front of somebody. It has to get them to react emotionally in order to purchase. So to me, it was more complex and more interesting than some of maybe the way I was taught finance and just the straight equation basis. So.
Yeah, and also probably requires more interactive and experiential learning. You can't really learn that by just vomiting up a bunch of equations.
No, and it's changing all the time, right? And so I think that was interesting. And I don't want to minimize, like, again, the fallacy of not knowing a ton about something and you think you know everything, right? Like, the less you know about something, the easier, the more approachable it may seem, right? Like heart surgery, right? I'm not a heart surgeon and would never purport to be. And so I don't know all the complexities that go into that. But I think a family member who was a psychologist actually related it to me that way. It's like, the heart is a known quantity. Psychology is a lot more complex. And so, yeah.
So you reroute to marketing and are way more deeply engaged and kind of stimulated by it. How did that manifest? Obviously, you're taking courses in that space. Are you diving more into deeper, more advanced courses? Did you explore any of that sort of thing work-wise during that time? You know, how is that growing interest kind of manifesting itself in your life?
Yeah, no, that's great. I worked with my dad's agency again. So I worked with him, I think, my freshman year in college, as I started to realize that finance wasn't my thing. That summer of my freshman year, I worked with his agency. And then after that, and I was consulting with clients. I was doing interviews. We had a client that was an FBO, which is airport for private planes. We did a consulting agreement with them, and I was doing a lot of customer interviews, talking to CEOs, which was interesting, about what they're looking for in their FBO and whatnot. That was really, again, I felt more in my element once again. And then after that, I went to ESPN and did a marketing internship there in New York City, which was kind of my first foray into New York City. And that's where I fell in love with New York City.
Tell me about that. So what was it about? Had you never been but had this vision for it, or did you get there and you felt like almost similar to switching from finance to marketing? You felt more immersed in like this kind of energy and engagement. What was it about New York that resonated with you?
Yeah, a couple of things. One, my grandmother on my mom's side, she grew up in New York in the Bronx. She was an Irish girl from the Bronx, Irish family. We had a long history there. Her granddad was like on the police force in New York City and would ride on a horse and like catch runaway carts and buggies. So like that the driver had fallen off the car to the buggy and there was a passenger inside and was running crazy through the New York streets. He would ride up next to him on a horse, jump off and like careen the stagecoach over to the side. Kind of thing.
It's like a movie.
Yeah. Like a real movie. Like that was pretty awesome. So I'd always heard these like stories and you know, my grandmother having roots there. So that was interesting. The second part was just the energy of New York City. Like my dad always told me, like, you know, play in a bigger pond. You know, it's better to be in a bigger pond, especially early, because you're going to be swimming next to bigger fish, right? And so you can pick up more quicker. And that, I think that was just it. New York City had was just eye-opening to me. I'd been there as a kid, but to be there on my own, it was really powerful. It's a stark contrast between College Station, Texas and New York City. And I loved it. I loved everything about it. I loved the openness of it. I loved the energy of it. I loved the idea flow. I loved that there was like an edge, you know, to New York of like, hey, if you're walking around and then all of a sudden there's nobody around you, you know, you're in the wrong spot, right? I think that kind of like the danger, but also the excitement and the energy, it all came together in a really meaningful and impactful way. And it felt like the top. Like if I could work in, you know, the whole Frank Sinatra, you make it here, you make it anywhere. That to me really like resonated because New York was, I mean, it was go, 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 go. Even as an intern, I was working 12-hour days, right? And in marketing. And I was like, wow, I'm alive. This is exciting. And then I can go home, maybe take a nap and then go out at 10 till 2 in the morning, right? That was what really attracted me in New York. And so working at ESPN, I felt really honored to be there. It was a really awesome opportunity. And I learned a tremendous amount. I was on the media side and we were selling media to agencies who were buying it for their clients. And I knew I wanted to be eventually on the agency side at this point. So I leveraged that internship at ESPN for an internship with a media firm at McCann Erickson. It was called Universal McCann.
Just to pause you there, why did you know that you wanted to be on the agency side? What was it about the agency side that was compelling to you?
Yeah, I think at this point, you know, I'd passed on finance, right? And I'd kind of come full circle to it's okay to do what my dad did, right? I think part of me wanting to go into finance was this like blaze your own path, be separate, you know, don't just follow suit, right? But I think at this time I'd kind of come to terms with it and realized that I actually liked that. I enjoyed that piece of it. And so I wanted to be in a big agency, but I wanted to do it big. I want to be in New York City. Like that's where the best agencies in the world are. And so that's where I wanted to be. I want to be in New York City and working in advertising. And, you know, Mad Men hadn't come out yet. So I had no idea the history of it, right? But I knew that that's where I wanted to be. So I leveraged it to a media internship at Universal McCann. And then I knew that at the end of that, I wanted to be at account management and McCann Erickson. And so one summer at Universal McCann and then one summer at McCann Erickson. And that was incredible. I worked on clients like L'Oreal, Intel, InBev. You know, I assisted on Verizon. I mean, there was multiple different like major Fortune 500 companies that I got to work on, and that was just an incredible opportunity.
So, what sorts of things were you doing for those clients, and were there specific things that resonated more with you than others, or was the whole experience just right on target for you?
Yeah, so actually, the internships ended up leading into a job right out of college. And the most interesting thing that I was doing was I was on Intel out of college. And so I got to do a lot with social media, right? I was coming into play. This was 2006-ish. And so I created the MySpace page for Intel, which was their first toe dip into social media, which was a lot of fun. And so I had the senior account execs come to me and say, hey, do you know anything about this MySpace thing? Because Facebook, I think at the time, was still for college students only. And so, or more just switched over. But the point is MySpace was where it was at. And so I was like, yeah, I can help with this. And so I just created a MySpace page and it was Intel's. And, you know, we created a YouTube channel. And I think I even, at the time, I was like, okay, when I created the Intel's YouTube channel, I think I used my real name. So you could see like Intel's YouTube channel by BC Coleman 3, which they eventually changed over. But, you know, it was funny. It was very early on and I was getting to do what I felt like were these big things.
I feel like there's a theme here of you doing very interesting stuff and uplifting other people. Like you're helping people get tips, you're cold calling for new customers. You know, you're launching Intel's MySpace channel. It's just kind of fascinating.
You know, especially as you're coming up to an organization, you're contributing to the organization, right? And I think there's a lot to be said for those contributions that make you proud, because you're not setting the strategy, you're not setting the whole course and direction, and just leaning into this is important to my organization. So this is what I'm going to contribute, and this is how I'm going to show up. I think that's really important, and finding pride in those things. Some people, you know, clock in, clock out. That's fine too. I think it's where do you find your excitement? I've always drawn a lot of excitement from the work that I'm doing. It's not just a job for me. I'm looking for how do we create value? How do we add? And I probably wasn't using that terminology when I started out, but like I'm constantly seeking how do we create something that's special. And I think that's a good way to approach it.
So you're working at the agency, you're launching YouTube channels and MySpace pages. And so what came next in that journey for you? Kind of what was the next step leading you to where you are today?
Yeah, I was, I want to say I averaged like 78 hours a week for my first year there. So I put in 2 years in one. Now, part of that, you got to know about the ad agency world. Part of that was there was just a tremendous amount of work and we were understaffed on the account to try to make it profitable. The other part of that was if you stayed past, I want to say 8 p.m., then they paid for your dinner and you got a car service home. And so I would always work past 8 p.m. Because it was really cool to like take a car service back to your apartment when you're making, I was making $32,000 a year in New York City. This is like 2006. And it was like, I burned through that plus everything else I had saved in college and before my entire life. Like everything was gone by the time I left New York. But the point being is that those free dinners were really important, A, because it helped you with your budget. And B, it was kind of this flex that you could take a private car home. This is before Uber and all that, right? So like, you know, dial 7 was the car service and they would show up, you know, 9 o'clock, pick you up from the office and drive you home. And that was a perk back then. And so I was always working past 8 p.m. But also, it was this really interesting thing. So in agencies, you have this account management, which is more client service and more the business side of the account. And then on the other side, you have the creatives, right? The creatives bring the ideas to life, but they're two very like different personalities. And so on the business side, we get there, you know, at 9 a.m. on the East Coast because we had clients on the West Coast, so they weren't even getting to their offices yet. So we get there at 9 a.m. The creatives would show up around maybe 10:30, 11, and they would inevitably within the first 30 minutes of being there, they'd come in, they'd like put all their stuff down or whatever. Then they would leave to go get coffee at a coffee shop, and then they'd come back around noon. They would go eat lunch around 2. And then they would finally start working, right? And so then they would work from 2 until 11 o'clock at night. And so as an account person, you get there at 9. Well, a lot of times you're waiting on something they were producing to get back to the client. So you'd work from 9 till 11, right? So there's your days right there. So a lot of times you would work these crazy hours just because the creatives didn't want to show up at the same time as everybody else. And that was always like this tension, like this push and pull, because you get there early, you start getting all this work done, and then you're waiting for creatives to get something done. So you create more work to do. But that was fun.
Did you realize that in hindsight, or in the moment were you realizing that there were these kind of two archetypes of people, and obviously they're in different roles, but you know, had two different kind of personality types and skill sets? Was that something that you knew in the moment?
It was, because it's part of the industry. And so everybody talks about it like, oh, the creatives. You know, they come in late, they don't really work that hard. And then, you know, on the other side, the creatives are like, oh, the account management people, they're such sticks in the mud. They're like, they don't like to have any fun. They're more about like just the business. And so there's always this like left brain, right brain kind of tension between them. But it's very natural in the industry, and it happens all the time and everywhere. And I think sometimes you'll get the exceptions where you have somebody who's a great creative, but they understand the business side really well. And then those people are gold. And the other way around too, a great, great account management who also understands the creative. Now people, I think over time, you know, as you develop in that career path, you start to share more traits. And so as you get higher and higher, you do share more traits. However, I would say there are, I don't call, maybe unicorns we'll call them, but like people who truly embody both sides. And those are, you know, they end up being founders of agencies or long-term, highly successful advertising industry leaders. So.
So you're in New York working your butt off. And at some point you started working with more kind of restaurant clients and into that space, and also not as much in New York at some point. So when did those steps and changes happen, and what were the catalysts for those?
Not making $32,000 a year anymore. no, just quite honestly, it was not intentional, right? Like I did not set out to say, well, I've got the advertising part. I got to get the restaurant part. I didn't ever set that. I thought restaurants for me were gone, and it was really quite random. My brother was a NASCAR driver, and he was racing on Joe Gibbs' team, and his sponsor was.
Hold on, we're gonna need to circle back to that, but keep going.
His sponsor was Johnny Carino's, an Italian chain based out of Austin, Texas. And I got introduced to the CEOs of Johnny Carino's and was telling them all the stuff, fun stuff we're doing in marketing for Intel and these other companies, and got an offer to lead marketing for Johnny Carino's. And at the time, I was in my early 20s and sort of lead marketing for, I think they had like 140 restaurants at the time, which is a massive, massive chain. But to lead marketing for a 140-unit restaurant chain was an incredible opportunity.
Especially at that age,
right? And yeah, and so there were two CEOs, Norman Abdallah and Creed Ford, who gave me this opportunity that was beyond my experience, is what I'll say. They gave me a lot of trust that changed my entire career. And I worked with Norman for years thereafter and stayed friends with the Fords. And unfortunately, Creed Ford has passed. But he was such a big influence on my life, as well as Norman was a huge influence on my life. And they were incredible people. And so as soon as I got this taste of like working in restaurants with like the hospitality, the people aspect coming back to the forefront, it was like, click, this is it. This is it, home. And I don't think I fully realized it for years that it was the bringing back these two experiences that were so formative from my childhood into this one idea. And I know it seems so like obvious. Well, like you worked in restaurants, you worked in advertising, and now you're working in marketing and advertising for restaurants. Like, yeah, that's pretty obvious, but I don't think it clicked, but it felt right. Right. And so initially it was this opportunity to make more money. And then I loved the work. I love trying to figure out what drove the business. And very early on, I'll tell you a story. So I came out of New York and I thought, you know, when you're young and you just think you hang the moon, at least I did. But I thought, you know, I'm just going to crush this. And so I came in, I'm like, yeah, I got confidence. I'm leading marketing for this. Of course I am. I just worked at an ad agency in New York City. And I'm just rolling my eyes at myself back then. But anyway, came in just completely confident. And I remember one of our first campaigns was this big Italian road trip, and I put all this effort into it. And it was a great campaign. I mean, I think the campaign side of it, the advertising side of it, was really well done. We worked with a great agency, you know, had the right insight on the customer, and we were thinking about the customer. What I missed was I wasn't thinking about the teams. And so I go in on the first day of the campaign and I sit down at our restaurant and off of Brody Lane. And I remember, you know, like the server coming over and I'm so proud. I was like, yeah, excuse me. I'd like to order this Italian road trip. And the server looks right at me, having no idea who I am, you know, that I'm the head of marketing. And she goes, I wouldn't do that. That's not a good deal. And I was just sitting there just like, oh, crap. I've missed something huge, right? Like I was just like, oh my God. So I said, okay, what would you recommend? And she recommended something else and doing something else on the menu. And so I went with her order or her recommendation, ate my lunch, waited for the whole crowd to die down. And then I said, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? And she's like, giving me this weird look, like, yeah. I said, look, I run marketing. And she goes, no, I'm so sorry. I was like, no, I'm sorry. Like, what did I miss? Like, help me understand. Why would you not want your customer to get this? We put all this money into advertising and marketing and selling and getting people here. Why'd you try to sell me off of it? And she walked me through the implications of this promotion at lunch, what it did to the kitchen. She walked me through what it did to her check. and how it hurt her tips. And like, so she gave me this whole perspective that I didn't bother to get. And that was a formative moment is again, putting people first, but like not just the guests, but your teams, your internal teams who have to execute and deliver this. And I think that gave me a huge differentiation from a lot of restaurant marketers very early on. A lot of times in restaurant marketing, you'll hear this tension between restaurant marketing and operations. And it's because marketing constantly wants to do something that damages operations or makes it difficult for them to execute. But it just sounds simple. Oh, yeah, just take a few extra steps. Well, you take a few extra steps times, you know, 8 team members times however many shifts, however many days, and all of a sudden it becomes a lot, right? And operations is about simplification. Marketing wants to do something that stands out. So sometimes that means taking a few extra steps and that complicates the execution. So I think understanding this from a very young age as both a restaurant marketer and as a young age, like a very malleable leader, that was really impactful for me. And so that became kind of my go-to is I would always bring in restaurant ops people on the ideation phase so they could help us make sure this was right for restaurants. But that was my first foray into restaurants. And I ended up working at Johnny Carino's for some time.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but the EQ level to realize that and be willing to like stay behind and ask her what the issue was and then pretty quickly realize, oh, I missed this. That's like a fairly high EQ insight and action for someone that's in their mid-20s and like riding high confidence-wise. So,
well, I appreciate that, but I think it was more fear, if I have to be honest, because this was day one of my first big campaign and we invested a ton of money into it. And I just saw this massive risk to it instantly. And I was like, what is this risk? And so like, I appreciate the compliment. I don't think I had that level of EQ at that time. I had more curiosity. And I think that curiosity is what drove me. But I think EQ is, I'm going to go back and say EQ is absolutely positively one of the biggest attributes a leader needs. And mine has certainly developed a lot over time. But I don't think I had a lot of EQ in my mid-20s. I think it was more curiosity of what went wrong and trying to solve the problem.
What happened with that one? So did it roll out and did it do all right? Did it fall flat? Was it a huge success?
It did all right, but it did all right. Yeah, like it was, I think we got a 6% lift in same store sales, which was a good lift for us for our campaigns. It was more than our average campaign, which was great, but I still saw there was a weakness in it because, you know, obviously I didn't bat 1,000 when we were selling this promo inside the restaurants. Because some people were pushing against it. I always think about things in a funnel, and that's my marketing brain, I think, is like, you know, size of addressable audience, and then, okay, well, who can actually take advantage of it? What limitations are we putting on it? And then that's your impact path. And the less that you can cut out from total addressable audience, if you say, oh, well, this is a very small audience, well, you better have a really high conversion rate, and you better be able to reach them in a very, like, targeted way. But I think if you're talking about mass campaigns, which is more yesteryears, a little bit depends. Well, it depends on your strategy these days. But if you're talking more about mass campaigns, you gotta make sure it's applicable to a large number of people because you're gonna hit a large number of people.
I wonder if you not had the experience early on in life of being immersed in a restaurant and like knowing what the back of the house looks like, knowing how the front operates. Like I wonder if you maybe wouldn't have even known or had the sense to like ask and then quickly connect, oh, this is like really hard to execute on. You know what I mean? I feel like
that's a great point.
That immersion early on and knowing how complex the beehive is was probably a big advantage for you in how rapidly you were able to kind of like learn and adapt in that sort of scenario.
Yeah, it instantly gave credibility to what she answered with. Like when she answered, well, this is what it does in the kitchen, I was like, oh, okay. That instead of going like, oh, well, they can get over that. I was like, oh, okay, I get it. Like, I know how crazy kitchens are. And now I've made it more complex because I'm trying to draw things from multiple stations and get them to hit the expo at the same time. And so it certainly helped. It certainly helped.
So what happened next? So you've launched a campaign, you get a 6% uplift in same source sales, which is like, all things considered, pretty great outcome. what was next there and what was next in kind of your trajectory to where you ultimately are?
So with that, you know, we did a lot of campaigns. I did a lot of test and learn. We tried different tactics, and these two mentors I had, Creed was more the creative guy, the marketing guy, the idea guy, and Norman was operations and finance and execution. And together they made the whole business better, right? Two CEOs, two different backgrounds and two different focuses, but both were accretive to the business, right? In different ways. And so I worked with both of them. You know, Creed and I had these great ideation sessions, and he helped me think more about customers and how to relate to customers. And then Norman was helping me learn the operation side and the finance side. So Creed was more of what I knew, but more experienced there. And Norman was more of this new area, right? And so I worked with them, and they gave me incredible opportunities, and we did some amazing things. I mean, we created some of the first campaigns of different types, because I was a young guy, just like, what if we did this? What if we did that? Like, again, speaking up, right? That comes full circle too from the early days of the ad agency. And so we would try things and we would test and learn. And there were a number of different things that we did that were kind of first of their kind. And some of them worked and some of them failed massively, which was a great learning opportunity. But fast forward, Norman and Creed split. And first I stayed with Creed, and then Norman went to work in Egypt, I believe. And then he came back to the States and was going to run a restaurant concept up in the Pacific Northwest. It was a number of brands. It was like Palomino, Cutter's, it was Stanford's, it was Henry's Tavern, and it was called Restaurants Unlimited. So it was a bunch of different brands. It was actually 14 different brands, 33 restaurant locations, wow. 14 brands. And it was based in Seattle. And so Norman asked me if I would come lead his marketing. And so I led marketing. I went to Seattle because it sounded like an incredible opportunity to lead marketing at Restaurants Unlimited and work with all these different brands. And plus, you know, being young, I wanted to go and see other places. So I moved to Seattle, had an incredible time there, was there for about a year. And we were able to, this is my first introduction in deeper into the financing side. And at the time, this one was owned by Sun Capital. And the initial plan was, what Norman wanted to do was he wanted to bring these restaurants into a better performance tier. So we were really underperforming. Honestly, we were not far from bankruptcy at the time and low on cash. And so we did all these like cash generating ideas early on. Like, we're going to sell gift cards in the summer, and we called it Christmas in July, and give this huge discount on gift cards if you bought them in July. And that drove cash up. And so we drove cash so we could sustain the business, didn't have to file. And then we used that cash to rebrand some of the core multi-unit concepts, because you have 33 restaurants. Some of those were single individual restaurant brands, and some of them were multi-unit. So we focused on the multi-unit because we could make one change, roll it out to, you know, 10 to 12 restaurants, and then drive that whole brand forward, which would have a bigger impact on the bottom line. So we made changes we focused on Palomino and Stanford's, because we thought those were the brands with the best opportunity. And we had just some incredible returns from reshifting these branding, the brand positioning on both of these. Stanford's, we failed to listen to the guest. And so we did a listening tour where we went back, talked to the guests, talked to the team members. Again, you see that theme coming back of putting the team members and the guests first. Listening to them and understanding what was wrong, why we were seeing negative 20% in sales. And we actually drove that brand from negative 22% to positive 11% within the first 6 months of being there. And that was really about listening to the guests, understanding what they were seeking, what had gone wrong. And then we did a campaign using this kind of Sam Elliott style voice that engenders a lot of trust, because they had lost trust in the brand. And so we wanted to get trust back. And the whole campaign was called Stanford's We're Back, right? You have a 22% dip from prior year. You obviously did something that changed the brand in a negative way. And so bringing this We're Back messaging and showing the trust through the voice and through the creative, that brand took off like a rocket ship. We went from negative 22 to positive 11, and we're able to sustain that even without media. So that was incredible. And then Palomino, we took negative to positive as well.
Were there any operational changes that came with that to kind of deliver on that, you know, that we're back?
Yeah. And Norman was really big on that. Like, we're not just going to go out and market something different. We're going to change the whole concept to meet a new value proposition. And so that's what we did. We changed the whole concept back to this we're back mentality. Everything aligned. We got the team members aligned. We had internal campaigns and external campaigns. So we had to market to our own team members why this was important. Why were we changing? Why are we looking for a different direction? Now, a lot of it was just regurgitating the things that they had told us we needed to do, but we needed everybody to be on the same page. And man, it took off. So we saw that. We saw Palomino and Stanford's take off, both using the same process, obviously different outcomes. Palomino wasn't a word back campaign. It was more of a brand elevation to premium, but the Stanford's campaign had this massive swing. And so the whole idea was we were going to change the direction of these multi-unit brands and then start to sell off some of the single unit brands. And so we went to Sun Capital. Their strategy changed. Norman wasn't aligned with where their strategy changed to. And so Norman started looking for something new and ended up being the CEO of Romano's Macaroni Grill. And that was my first CMO role, is moved going with Norman to Macaroni Grill. So that was an incredible opportunity as well. And just a furthering of the restaurants. Like, I'm fully into restaurants at this point. I'm focused on the marketing side. And Macaroni Grill, I started to pick up the culinary side more so, which is just a lot of fun and a real passion of mine. But started to do that with Macaroni Grill and had this big turn in Macaroni Grill. They were purchased by Golden Gate Capital. They did a sell lease back. They got, you know, all their money back from the sell lease back. But now it's negative $5 million in EBITDA and we've got to turn it quick. And I think that first year that we were there in Romano's Macaroni Grill, we went from negative $5 million in EBITDA to, I want to say we were like $22, $23 million in EBITDA that year. So wow. It was a huge swing.
What was the driver of that?
I think a couple of things. One, the primary driver was it was purchased from Brinker. Golden Gate Capital purchased On the Border and Macaroni Grill from Brinker. At that time, they were still running the business. When we got there, they were still running the business like it was a Brinker business. And Brinker owns Chili's and Maggiano's, and they used to own a lot more concepts, but they were a very big organization. So I think there was a lot more room for, I don't want to say there was inefficiencies, but it wasn't being run like a small company, right? There was a person for everything. And the challenge with that was, in small companies, you don't get a person for everything, right? In a bigger company where you've got extra resources that drive extra EBITDA, maybe you're thinking about all these other opportunities and you're hiring a person just for ESG or something like that. Well, we needed to combine roles and do more with less people. And so there was a restructuring that happened. That was big. I think, you know, we went through and cut a lot of costs. I would say we went too far, and that was a good lesson, right? That was one of the mistakes, that we went too far on cutting costs. So we cut kind of costs across the board, from everything from Macaroni Grill used to have these fresh gladioli flowers, and they'd bring these fresh flowers in multiple times a week. We cut those. And I think that was one that we went too far. That was one that the guest really noticed. And that was a good lesson, right? We got a ton of feedback. So there's certain things that the guests key in on, and there's certain things that the guests don't key in on, right? The guest doesn't care what type of insurance you have.
How do you figure that out? Is that comes back to like immersing yourself and getting really close to the client and the client experience?
Yes, but the takeaway that I had from that experience was, if you're going to go through one of these massive cost-cutting exercises, look at like everything that doesn't touch the guest first. Like, focus on, you know, your linen contracts, your insurance, your everything that doesn't touch the guest, cut with extreme aggression. Like, be very aggressive there. There's no risk to sales. Like, in the restaurant business, sales, there's a saying that says sales cures all. And so I'm not saying this is applicable to every business, but for restaurants or thin margin businesses, it is 100% applicable. Cut everything you can out of this stuff that doesn't touch the guest experience. And then be very cautious on the things that touch the team member experience, and be exceptionally delicate with the things that touch the guest experience. Because losing a guest it has a snowball effect, right? If you start losing sales, you have to cut more to get back to where you were. And then you end up cutting more of the experience, and then you lose more guests. And so it kind of has this snowballing effect, or a downward spiral. If you leave those to your last cuts, and you're very, you know, thoughtful about testing through those, then you can cut some stuff out of the guest experience, but very little, because people have an expectation. And I think that's the whole thing. All this is about expectation. If I was going into a divey restaurant, I wouldn't expect fresh flowers, but you've been giving me fresh flowers for decades. So I expect fresh flowers when I walk into a macaroni grill. And so that's the way I would think about it, is start with the things that don't touch the guests and be very aggressive on those. Be careful on the things that impact your team, and make sure you explain the why as you go through those. On the guests, you don't get a chance to explain the why. And while they may see it as one vase of fresh flowers, I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of dollars for a giant chain of 210 restaurants to put in flowers every week. So,
yeah, super interesting. And so you're having some of these very insightful experiences pretty significantly impacting these businesses in a leadership kind of CMO role. And then at some point you switched from the CMO seat to the CEO seat. Tell me about that kind of journey, and, you know, kind of your first forays into that, and how that led to what you're doing now.
Yeah. So it was actually at Macaroni Grill. I saw some opportunities that I would have done differently. Not saying that I would have been right, but just that I would have handled differently. You know, just different aspects of the business that I didn't have purview of. So I set this vision for myself. I said, I want to do it differently, right? I want to lead differently. I want to be the CEO of a business that engages my, and let's see if I can recall this vision statement. I want to be the CEO of a business that engages my soul and my mind. That was it. And so every morning when I woke up, I would read that statement, and I would think about, you know, when I made decisions, like, how does this influence my ultimate vision? And I started to share that vision. So I think there's three steps to, like, creating a successful vision. And I think this goes for both leading a company and for personal. It's vision setting. So what are you trying to achieve? And it needs to be specific. I mean, it doesn't need to necessarily be a SMART goal, but it needs to be specific enough that you can measure against it. You need to repeat it. It needs to be more of a mantra, something that you look at every day, you read to yourself every day, you state every day. And so whether that's personal, you know, like finding time to, you know, putting 5 minutes on your calendar every day to repeat your vision statement. And then, you know, I think that if you're in a company, maybe it's putting a poster up where everybody sees it in the break room or in their offices. And then you reiterate it on calls, and you reiterate it in meetings. So I think that repetition is important. The setting, repetition, and then sharing. I don't think a vision should be some sort of, like, secretive, confidential information that you don't want others to have. A vision should be shared, because if you enroll others, I think enrollment is probably a better word. If you enroll others in this vision, then they can help you achieve it, right? Like, if they know you're going for CEO, then they're not going to bring you a CMO role, but when they hear about a CEO role, they're going to bring it to you, right? Or if, as in my case, I did CMO for Macaroni Grill, I did CMO for a tech company, I did contract work, marketing, and then I was CMO of Del Frisco's. And, you know, I told everybody that this was my vision. And when the president exited for Del Frisco's Grill, I got the opportunity to step into this general management role, which is close to the CEO role, because they knew that's what I was seeking, right? And I had made decisions along the way to get more involved with operations. Like, if I'm going to be a CEO, then, man, I need to get more involved with operations. If I'm going to be a CEO, I need to better understand the finance. And so taking that initiative to act on the things that would align with the vision that I had set, and then was repeating every day and sharing with others, that is where I got to the president of Del Frisco's Grill. And that was in 2017.
That's awesome. Which, by the way, to me feels like that's a manifestation of speaking up in some of your experiences early on, with speaking up to the outside world, but also to yourself. Like, this is what I think, this is what I'm going to go do. And, you know, enrolling other people in understanding and hopefully supporting that, you know, that vision. So I feel like there's a lot of embedded lessons early on that have, it seems like, have really, you know, benefited you and getting to where, you know, you wanted to build to.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate.
That's awesome. So You're at Del Frisco's, and then what happens next, and what has led you ultimately to Cotton Patch?
Del Frisco's was a great, great opportunity. Again, that I hadn't led a concept before, and I got this opportunity to lead a concept. And we had incredible results. We were able to change an 11 quarter negative same store sales slide and turn that brand positive. We were able to improve EBITDA and operations and get that brand into a better position. And at the same time, you know, we were part of this big group where we had Del Frisco's, Double Eagle, the big steakhouse. We had the Grill, and then we had Barcelona and Bar Taco. We ended up taking the business private through an acquisition by Catterton, and I was supposed to stay on board. But we were evaluating whether or not, you know, do we franchise the steakhouses, because they were going to separate out Barcelona and Bar Taco into their other platforms, and then the steakhouse business was the question mark. And do we franchise it or do we sell it? Because I didn't think they wanted to be they didn't want to be the long term operators of it. And so we actually ended up selling it to Tillman Fertitta. And at that point, I exited the business in November of 2019 on great terms. Just this, you know, I'm going to move on to the next step. And I went through a couple of deals with private equity groups where we were looking at buying something, and I was going to step in as the president or the CEO, and they kind of fell through. And then I got a call for the CMO role at Dave & Buster's. And that was just an incredible opportunity. And then I think this was a bit of a miss. Well, it's interesting. You could say it's a misstep, or you could say it's a learning opportunity. I'm going to call it a learning opportunity. It was such an attractive offer, right? Like this public company, and Del Frisco's was public too, but this is a bigger public company, $2 billion company. It's got entertainment aspect to it. It's a huge name. It's a category leader. There's so much fun stuff you can do with the brand. So it was like a marketer's dream. I was like, man, that is an incredible marketing opportunity. If I went back to my vision, did it align with my vision statement that I was setting? Probably not. And I think I got a little antsy because I went through two. I didn't fully understand, you know, the partnership process with private equity and like becoming a CEO and then, you know, like waiting to find something and how long that was going to take. And I had a severance and I was thinking, man, I want to bank this severance. I don't want to burn it. So I said, you know what? I'm going to go for it. And it turned out to be the perfect experience. It was the experience I needed. It put me in a much bigger company, much bigger role, went through the pandemic with Dave & Buster's, which was crazy. You know, you think restaurants got it hard. Try a place where you have both restaurant, eating and dining, and you put your hands on every single thing in the building, and there's kids. And so like, that business was decimated right after COVID. But anyway, we got this awesome opportunity to do zero-based budgeting where we reset everything, created more of an emotional brand positioning for Dave & Buster's, led to one of Dave & Buster's best quarters ever. I think it might still be the best quarter ever. I haven't checked recently, but we had some incredible wins. And then we merged with Main Event. New CEO came in, great leader, Chris Morris. He came in, he had his team from Main Event, brought them over and merged business, move on. No problems here because it was a great exit for me. And then jumped in with TGI Fridays through a mentor, Ray Blanchett, who was an incredible leader of Fridays. Had some challenges with that business. Not going to go into depth there, but I'll just say some challenges that made it difficult to succeed, and worked with the private equity group, actually ended up becoming CEO of TGI Fridays, and realized that we had very different perspectives on how to take the business forward. And while initially my perspective was well received as I was, you know, fighting for that role, that CEO opportunity, it became apparent that that was no longer the path forward, that wasn't going to be a successful way. In my opinion, it was the successful way, but that wasn't the way that the private equity group was going to take it. So we agreed to part ways because we had just totally different perspectives on the business. And at that time, I joined Cotton Patch Cafe, and I have had just such an incredible time leading this brand because it is a brand of people who want to win. And I'm not saying that anything about any of my past businesses. There's tons of people that want to win in all those businesses, but In this business, talking specifically about Cotton Patch Cafe, we've got a lot of team members that want to win, you know, they went through a downturn after it was purchased by private equity. And so there's a lot of opportunity and upside. And in the first, gosh, I've been there 8 months, we've been able to capture tremendous upside and really drive this business to where people are seeing the success. They're seeing the success for the team members with employee engagement higher than it's ever been. They're seeing success for the guests with guest ratings higher than they've ever been. And they're seeing the success come through on the bottom line with a tremendous improvement in EBITDA. We've got a campaign out now that's starting to turn sales positive. And we've just in traffic getting back to flat. I mean, we're really driving this business in a new direction, which is allowing us to recover quickly and create a huge impact and a lot of value for our stakeholders, which is
that's awesome.
It's fun to win, man. We are on a rocket ship right now.
That's exciting. What was your process, having all the experiences you've had leading up to Cotton Patch? Did you know going in, okay, this is what I'm going to do first, this is what I'm going to do next? Did you know going in what you're going to do, or either like very specifically tactically or just stylistically how you wanted to approach it? Or what was your approach to being able to, you know, achieve that based on all your experiences leading up to it?
Yeah, I think it's really important when you go into these businesses not to assume you know anything and to really empty your cup. Now, there's certain tried and true formulas that work in the restaurant business, but if you go in with a playbook and go, here's what I'm going to do. You know, I do this every time and it always works. That's not going to work, because what happens is you're not taking into consideration the stories that are being told by the team, right? And that's very important, right? We talk about expectations, what people expect when they show up and what do they get, right? And sorry, I'm going to go down a rabbit hole for a second again. If I tell you a movie is great and you go and it's good, you're disappointed. If I tell you a movie is bad and you go and it's just good, you're excited because it's better than you thought it was. So the absolute value of that movie as good didn't change. The way I set you up for what you expected walking in changes your happiness with the outcome. So the outcome was the same. It was a good movie, average, probably a better word, average movie, right? The expectation changes. And so a lot of people, when you think about running teams, and restaurant businesses are not about food at all, they're all about people. When you think about running large organizations full of people, you have to address the stories. You can't just come in and go, this is the way we're going because A, B, and C, and I know better, or we've got a better answer. You're gonna fail miserably because you're not enrolling the team in it. And so the first thing we did is we listened. I went to restaurants. I went all around Texas, visited more restaurants than they had in the past, and started listening
immersing.
To people, started hearing what they were
getting
saying.
Getting in the weeds.
Immersing. Getting in the weeds and seeing what people felt, what their stories were, hearing what they thought needed to change, looking at the numbers to verify it, right? Because sometimes the story doesn't align with what's happening. And so you have to correct the story. And so we did all this, like just immersion into all the, and of course, listening to the guests, seeing all the guest data that we had. We had, you know, I work with Altamont Capital. They're an incredible private equity group. They did this great Bain study. So there's tons of research and data coming into this, looking at the business and being able to read it all on paper, but also getting out and seeing and feeling it with the team. So that's the first part. It's just like intake. Like I think I know some stuff about this concept. I empty my cup. I learn everything I can. Then once you start to see some common themes, you start to pressure test with people. Well, I heard this. Did you tell me about that? And they're like, oh yeah, let me tell you about that. And you can see where people really lean in and I don't think that's a thing. So then you start to pressure test some ideas and some different themes. That drives you to starting to identify and prioritize, right? Because could you change everything? Yeah, you can change everything. You'll fail because you won't focus on what's most important. And so prioritization is key. So intake, and then pressure testing, and then prioritization, and then vision setting, repeating, and enrolling, right? And so I think that's the way we get everybody on the same page, and you kind of create a burning platform as well. And I do that just through transparency. Usually if I'm in a turnaround situation, the most of the people in the business have no idea it's a turnaround situation. And so I show them, I say like, look, you know, this downward trajectory doesn't leave us in a good place. And they're like, oh, wow. And a lot of times a great way to do that is just ask them, what do you expect our earnings were last year. What do you expect we made last month? And they'll throw out a bunch of numbers, and inevitably in a turnaround, they're wrong, right? They always think they're doing much better than they are. Otherwise, you wouldn't have ended up there. But you kind of create that burning platform. You say, okay, so this is why we're going to do some new things. And what I heard from you were these things are important. You know, these three things. Well, we're going to take those three things. We're going to do those three things. And maybe there's something else that they didn't know about, right? Or they hadn't seen, and that you could bring from your own experience. And we're going to do these two things because these are going to do this, right? And so you bring them along in the story. They're buying into the story, and then they can help you retell that story and live that story so that you end up in a better place. And it seems there's a lot of soft skills to it, because you're working with people, and the soft skills are people. And unfortunately, a lot of times culture and things like that are like considered too soft to like really quantify. And you can't quantify them, so they don't matter. I think it was Einstein that said, like, wait, not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. But the point being is the soft stuff does matter. And so just because you can't measure it doesn't mean you shouldn't focus on it. Now, when you're reporting out to your board, it gets maybe a little less attention, a little less focus, but you should let the board know, because if you have experienced board members, they'll know how important that is. But you should let the board know that that's part of your plan, is this kind of storytelling, this listening, this giving feedback, and this kind of painting a new trajectory for the business. So that's what we did. And there were things that, you know, we focused on three things, okay? Focus on the guest, the team member, and the shareholders. So for the guest, we wanted to win back our core brand promise. And that was quality food. It was best in class value and Texas hospitality type of service. So there were three legs to the stool. We had lost two of them, really the value and the service aspect. We still had this great quality food. So we want to win back those other two. That's the guest piece. For the team, our team felt unsupported. They felt like we didn't give them the right tools to succeed. And then when we were in the restaurants, we beat them up and tore them down. And so we flipped that script on what our role was when we went into restaurants, how much support we were going to give our team members, what our benefits and perks look like. So we changed that story. The third piece for our shareholders, there was a ton of value locked up in the preparation of our food. This brand had long-term been, you know, a vast majority of the food was produced from scratch. The fallacy was thinking that things were the same as they were in 2016. In 2016, I think our average wage rate was closer to $11, $12 an hour for the back of the house. Now it's closer to like $16, $17. So there's a massive change in what it costs to prep a ton of scratch food. And so what we started looking at is, where are their efficiencies? Where are their optimizations? Can we do less menu items, prep less, in order to get this food out in a profitable way and not overinvest in labor? Those were the three things: the guest, the team, and the shareholder. We put a very clear metric to each one of those, what we were going to move. The guest was about traffic. Team member was about turnover, voluntary turnover. And then the EBITDA was about, or excuse me, EBITDA was the metric for, or excuse me, no, no, prime cost was the metric for the last one. Prime cost is your labor plus your food cost. And so those were the metrics we focused on. And that's been the key to our success, is focusing on three simple things: the guest, the team, and the shareholder, and pushing that in everyday meetings, everyday phone calls, and everyday's in the restaurant.
That's awesome. I feel like there's a consistent theme, at least from this conversation, that you've been executing on successfully for a number of years, which is like, immerse, step one. Step two, like, speak up and contribute. And step three, like, in doing that, uplift, you know, the business, the people, whatever organization you're involved in. So I think maybe I just came up for the title of the episode with that, but
that's great. Nailed it. That's great distillation. I love it.
We figured it out. That's awesome. Thank you for sharing. And it's really cool to hear your story and how that's manifesting in all the great stuff you're doing with Cotton Patch. So thank you for taking the time and for sharing. I'll end the episode the same way I end each of these episodes, which is by asking kind of our standard question of, goofily modeled after the take a penny and leave a penny dish at a convenience store. But, you know, if you had to leave one thing, whether it's a tip or a trick or a book or a habit that has helped you in your building journey, what is that? And then similarly, I'll ask you, you know, if you could take one thing from our audience, what, you know, in terms of them visiting Cotton Patch, or them, you know, something that they can help you with in something that you care about or that you're working on, what would that be?
So what am I going to leave? I think one of the biggest things, and we didn't touch on it, but one of the biggest factors in my life and things that have created success for me in relationships, personally, as well as professionally, is radical accountability. And you hear this idea thrown out a lot. And I think it kind of becomes fodder sometimes because people just like, oh yeah, let's be accountable here. Let's have radical accountability. But like, what does that mean? And the way that I always relate it to people is, okay, in Texas, if you get rear-ended at a stoplight, it's the person who is behind you's fault, right? No matter what. Even if you hit your brakes too fast, whatever you did, the person behind you, it's their fault for running into the back of you. So let's just run through a scenario where I'm sitting at a stoplight and somebody rear-ends me. I can say, it's their fault. I had nothing to do with this. You know, end of story, right? File my insurance claim, go get my car fixed, go to the chiropractor, you know, maybe have massage therapy, whatever it all takes, right? But it takes time, effort, money to get all this corrected, right? So there is a cost to me, even though I didn't have a say in it, or I didn't have anything to do with it. It wasn't my fault, right? And so people get stuck on that. It wasn't me. Like, it was the weather. It was this person. It was this vendor. It was this thing, right? Okay, well, if that's the approach you take, you are just as likely to have the same cost, the same time expended, the same pain the next time you pull up to a stoplight. So you've done nothing to change your future. And so the approach I take is, yeah, that wasn't my fault. That was technically their fault, but that's not where it's going to stop. Okay. So what can I do differently to avoid this? Because it hurts. It costs me money and it costs me time. So next time I pull up to a stoplight, I guess I could leave more space in between the person in front of me and myself. So if I could check my rearview mirror too. That's another thing I could do because I might see them coming, right? I might see that they're not slowing down. And then if I left space, then I could pull out of the way. Maybe that's a great idea. Maybe I could have broke a little bit slower, right? Instead of being so aggressive on the brakes and then cause that person behind me who wasn't paying attention not to realize, I could have, you know, used the brakes, I could have feathered the brakes in and seen that they weren't slowing down, maybe changed lanes, got out of the way, maybe use my horn to honk, alert them. There's things you can do. Even in the worst situations, if you had absolutely no control over anything, you can control your mindset. You control how you see a problem, how you experience it, right? And there's tons of research, and I won't go into too much depth on all the different ideas around this, but if you can control your mindset, you can change how you experience something. You now have power over the circumstances. So the definition of accountability, to rise above one's circumstances and demonstrate ownership to achieve your desired results, right? So even if you're a prisoner, you can think differently about how you're experiencing prison. What could I do here? How do I think about this changes my experience with it? And the last thing I'll leave you with around this idea is a couple of resources. One would be a book, The Oz Principle, I think is a great accountability book. And I've read it multiple times and gone through multiple trainings around this book. And then the second one I would leave you with is a course I took called Landmark, in which it breaks down kind of the stories versus the facts. And then it breaks down language as a whole. And then it rebuilds all this and reconstitutes it as, you know, your mindset, your perspective. And then the final course, there's three courses. The final course is about enrolling others in whatever your vision is. So I think there's some really powerful things in Landmark, and there's other courses too. And there's plenty of resources around accountability, but think about accountability as like, where in your life have you said, it's not me, it's them. And then that's where you need the most accountability and to rise above the circumstances. And I just cannot stress enough that taking the time to train yourself in this way, it will really have a positive impact on your life personally and professionally.
Man, that's great. But thank you for sharing that. How can our audience community, what's something that we can be helpful with for you on?
Go to Cotton Patch Cafe. I know it sounds simplistic, but I mean, go enjoy some great chicken fried steak, chicken fried chicken, or, you know, the grilled pork chop is my favorite. That's a killer product. We have a new menu launching on October 23rd. Oh, and this month we're also donating $1 for every dessert sold. We're donating $1 to the Giving Kitchen, which is an incredible organization that helps out, you know, restaurant employees who are in need across the nation. So the Giving Kitchen is a great cause. And if you go to, so my ask is go to Cotton Patch Cafe and order dessert, And that's what my ask is, especially in October.
That's great. You're making me hungry, especially hearing about some of those dishes. So appreciate you sharing about the dishes, but more importantly, appreciate you sharing your story. And it's been great. I really enjoyed the conversation. So thank you for taking the time.
Dory, thank you so much. It's been awesome. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thanks everyone for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To join the Built to Outlast community and access episodes, show notes, and other community resources, please visit builttooutlast.com. If you have or know a business that may be sold and care who the buyer is, or want to build a business and care who you do it with, please visit enduring.co to learn more about us, our long-term approach, and our holding company.